Well, exactly. And the thing is, she was going to the kinds of people who claimed to be medical professionals, though. And they were telling her, don't cut burning poison. Here's the thing. If you find a lump, let's say you find a small lump in your prostate or a small lump anywhere or a breast lump, and it's the size of a peanut or even the size of a grape, you have to, at that very moment, get yourself, run, don't walk, to your local, whatever cancer facility you have, your local hospital, and say, there's a lump, I'm concerned. And they will tell you if it's cancer or not. And you need to deal with it while it's small, because if you deal with it while it's the size of a peanut or a grape, your chances of surviving with chemotherapy is not 2 to 3%. It's like 97 to 99%. It's really high. It's really, really high. But you have to get it out, and you have to kill the cancer cells. And once you get them out and you kill them, then there's a good chance it won't come back. If you wait, on the other hand, if you try what I did for 4 weeks, which I could just kick myself because I probably was better off before the 4 weeks, if you wait, the thing about cancer, it grows exponentially. So you know how you take two and you multiply it, and eventually it's growing so fast that you can't even keep track of it, right? That exponential growth curve.
Oh, yeah.
So the same thing is true with cancer. If you have a cancer the size of a speck, it's going to take it a long time to get to be the size of a peanut because it's got to make its way up to that. But once it's the size of a peanut, it's going to double. And then once that thing is that size, in the same amount of time, it's going to double. And pretty soon, it grows so quickly that you can't tackle it anymore. So get it when it's small. Don't wait even a minute, even a day. Don't wait. Go immediately and get it checked out and get it out of your body. And at that point, after you've survived the trauma, and it is trauma, I certainly didn't enjoy chemotherapy. It absolutely sucked. I did it for 18 months. My cancer was so far advanced that my oncologist at Dana-Farber down in Boston, one of the best cancer centers in the world, she sees patients from all over the world and has so for years. She told me she gave me more chemotherapy than she's ever given to any patient in her practice. And why did she do that? Because I'm young, relatively speaking, for cancer at least, and because the cancer was so far advanced and I was so on the edge of having it go metastatic that she wanted to beat it back with everything she could. And here's the amazing part. Had I not had that chemotherapy and that radiation, there is a 98% chance that I would currently be dead. And we know this because other women with 6-centimeter tumors and 12 positive lymph nodes who do not get treatment are typically dead within 2 to 5 years. So my chances of survival would have been less than, I think it's like 0.07%, 0.7% would have been my chances of survival had I not received treatment. With the treatment that I received, surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, I did all three. With the treatment that I received, my chances now of survival go way up to like 70 to 80% instead of 0.07%. So that's worth it to me to say I'll tolerate a year and a half of crap, which is what it was, going through chemo and losing my hair and my eyelashes and feeling like garbage. And, you know, chemo's no fun. It is poison. I'll admit it. But the poison killed the cancer, and I could build myself back. If I hadn't have killed the cancer would have killed me. And I would have died poison-free, but I would have died of an even worse enemy than poison, which is cancer. Mm. And I'll tell you, there's no more nasty enemy that you could ever go up against than cancer. And you fight it with everything you can, as hard as you can. You don't fight it with wimpy baking soda. I'm really sorry to say that, but you don't. You don't fight it with lemon juice. You don't fight it with vitamin C. You fight it with poison because we've tested the vitamin C. In stage 4, where nothing else has worked, why not? You could give it a shot.
You're talking intravenous 50 grams of vitamin C, or are you talking about supplements of it? Yeah,
I'm talking about both. I'm talking about both.
Because we had a guy in New Zealand here who had probably the worst case of swine flu that we had in this country. And when he was on the ECMO machine, they also scanned him and found out that he had hairy cell leukemia. Then they started him on the intravenous vitamin C, and a couple of weeks to a couple of months later, not only did he not have swine flu anymore, but he didn't have that hairy cell leukemia either.
Let's talk about the weight of empirical evidence, because here this is actually a really critical point. So anytime you talk about anything, cannabis, vitamin C. Name the treatment, the alternative treatment. Anytime you talk about it, people will always tell you, well, I know somebody who did X, and look what happened to them. The websites that you go to promoting these various treatments will say, look at these three testimonials of these three patients who were dying, they did this treatment, and now they're thriving and they're cancer-free, right? So we've all seen this.
Well, this one was on 60 Minutes, but yeah.
Right, well, and we can go into that one, but I just want to talk more generically about the kinds of general claims that people make for general cancer treatment. So we can put the vitamin C one to the side for just a second. So the difference between the testimonial-based evidence and the research-based, peer-reviewed, clinical, double-blind trial evidence is really vast. Because what you want to know is if you take 100 people who have hairy cell leukemia, and you take those 100 people and you give them all intravenous vitamin C, how many will respond by being, quote, cured? How many are going to get cured by that cure? So if you take 100 people with this disease and you give them all, let's just take one example, 100 people, and you give 100 people chemotherapy and you give 100 people intravenous vitamin C. I don't know the answer to this because I don't have the statistics in front of me, but let's just make a hypothetical case. Let's say that when you give 100 people chemotherapy who have hairy cell leukemia, 60 of them go into remission, and 40 of them continue to get worse and die. Now you take 100 people and you give them intravenous vitamin C, and 5 of them miraculously get better, and 95% of them get worse and die. I'm not saying that these are the right numbers. I'm making this up. But let's say if that were to happen, in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, they would say some patients, a very small number, showed improvement with the vitamin C treatment. The majority did not show improvement. In the testimonial world, where they don't have to report all those other statistics of the times it failed, they would say, look at these 5 case studies. Here's Jane Thompson, and she was dying of hairy cell leukemia, and she got vitamin C, and it cured her. Look, and it would be true. But when you are facing hairy cell leukemia, which of those two treatments do you want to do? The one with the testimony with the 5 smiling people. And by the way, the people who then have the 5 smiling people for their testimonial will then point to the 40 people who died with the chemotherapy and say, look, chemotherapy killed these 40 people, failed to save them. But look at these 5 smiling testimonials who were saved by our treatment.
Oh, yeah.
So the critical thing here when you're evaluating cancer treatments, if this were anything else, I wouldn't even spend this time on it because whatever. But we're talking about people's lives. And the critical thing in evaluating a cancer treatment, in saving people's lives or not, in putting people's lives at risk if you recommend the wrong thing, you need to look at the study of what's the big picture look like for this treatment. Not for this one guy whose life was over and then he was saved, but what's the big picture for all the people who get the treatment. And what you'll find is that in almost every case, these alternative treatments that are touted on the internet with testimonials do not do the double-blind, placebo-controlled trials that will give you those answers. And they never tell you, like all these clinics in Mexico that have websites, they'll never tell you about the 90 patients that died. They'll tell you about the 3 that thrived. And the reality is
it's a sales pitch.
H4 breast cancer. I'm sorry?
Well, basically, they're just giving you a sales pitch, you know, buy our product.
That's right. That's right. So listen, if you took 100 women with stage 4 breast cancer, stage 4, deadly. They're going to be dead. There's a 97% chance, or out of the 100 women, 97 of them will be dead within 3 to 5 years, typically sooner. What if you took your treatment, and let's say my treatment was I'm going to wave my magic feather over all 100 of them, and my magic feather does absolutely nothing, but I'm going to claim it does. 3 of those women are going to survive anyway. And when I'm done waving the magic feather, if I fail to tell you about the 97 who just died, but I only tell you about the 3 who thrived, and then I try to sell you my magic feather treatment for $10,000, everybody under the sun is going to want to buy it. See, this is why science, it's so important that people understand the scientific method. And as much as you might not like scientists, you might not like the pharmaceutical industry, and there's a whole lot of reasons not to, there's really good reasons to look at evidence-based treatments for cancer instead of testimonial-based treatments for cancer. And if there's one thing I can communicate to all your listeners who I know are learning about this, don't base any decision for any medical treatment on cancer based on testimonials alone, because it is all too easy to find the one exception who's going to survive and not tell you about the 97 who died when they did that treatment. And my aunt is the perfect case in point.
You totally need registered double-blind medical trials with backgrounds and the whole mass of studies and things of that nature. And I think Dr. Thomas Levy, who's also a lawyer, I think he came to New Zealand when we had this big 60-minute story about the guy who got his hairy cell leukemia and swine flu disappear because of intravenous vitamin C. And he revealed that there's actually been a 75-year history, including by Nobel Prize winners and what have you, actually verifying the efficacy of this basically being used against almost any virus. And it's interesting you said earlier that cancer's conscious, right? It has a consciousness.
Well, that's just my belief. That's not scientific. That's just Catherine Albrecht's personal opinion. But yes.
well, what that reminds me of is a book that was written called Dr. Mary's Monkey about this this girl who was incidentally going out with, I think, Lee Harvey Oswald at the time. She got advanced through her high school, university, all the way into the lab, because I think when she was in a high school lab, she managed to create a cancer virus. And the U.S. Government recruited her and gave her these skips ahead. You know, it's like, do you want to go straight to university at the age of 16 and skip the rest of high school? She's like, yeah. You want to skip the next few years of university and then go straight into a lab with your own team and everything? And you're like, yeah. So she develops this massive cancer virus that is so freaking deadly. And apparently it turns up in all the vaccines and everything. And hey, presto, we've got between 1 in 3 and a 1 in 2 cancer rate. So I'm of the opinion that cancer's not just a disease, it's an engineered bioweapon.
Well, the only thing, though, about cancer is it's been around with humanity for all of history. We've seen cancer in mummies that have been exhumed from Egyptian tombs. We see cancer in the animal kingdom. We see cancer in wild animals.
But do we see it at rates of 1 in 2?
Natural diet.
Yeah, but do we see it in rates of 1 in 2 and 1 in 3?
Oh, do we see what?
Do we see cancer rates in mummies and animals at rates of 1 in 2 or 1 in 3, though?
No, we don't. But here's the thing: if it were engineered, then we wouldn't see so much of it. Well, we'd see a lot of it now, but we wouldn't see any of it prior to the ability to engineer stuff. So we know that cancer's always been with humanity. It's been in the oldest, most ancient Greek and Roman writings of doctors and physicians back then. Cancer's always been with us. It's experiencing a huge increase because the things that fuel and feed cancer, especially the reproductive endocrine-based cancers that affect the prostate, the breast, the uterus, the ovaries, those kinds of cancers are increasing at a tremendous pace because of all the estrogenics in our society.
Do you believe that that's a deliberate a part of the New World Order agenda?
I do. So I'll say something very controversial here, that I believe that the wholesale introduction of soy into the human diet in almost every country on the globe was very specifically engineered by a man named Duane Andreas. He's the head of Archer Daniels Midland, or was for many years. And he traveled around the globe to take a toxic food that no human society has ever eaten in any quantity, which is soy, and turn it not only from a toxic food that nobody would touch, but turn it into a staple that is now the most commonly consumed oil on planet Earth, that now finds its way into virtually every food that people eat if they're eating processed foods. So what does that mean? Well, we know that soy is extremely estrogenic. And when I say extremely estrogenic, if you were to give a baby, infant formula made from soy, it's the equivalent of giving them a birth control pill a day. It's that estrogenic. So soy, being one of the most estrogenic foods that a human being can consume, has now been made a part of our diet, and we've been sold this bill of goods that it's actually a health food. Well, when men consume soy, it immediately reduces their testosterone level. How interesting. Well, that would make them less aggressive, wouldn't it? This is the reason why in prisons, there's been lawsuits actually in Ohio and elsewhere against the prisons, because they're feeding the men, instead of feeding them meat, They're feeding them soy protein artificial substitutes for meat, which is causing them all kinds of endocrine disruption, health problems, and is making them very docile. If men consume large quantities of soy, they stop growing beards. If men consume large quantities of soy, they become effeminate because estrogen is a feminizing chemical. It's a feminizing hormone that reduces male testosterone. So a couple of years ago, I was talking about this on my own radio show, kmashow.com, if people want to check it out. But I was talking about the soy problem in men. And I had a listener contact me afterwards, and he said, you know, Catherine, you might have saved me because I went to Sam's Club or whatever big wholesale club, and I bought a huge case of soy milk. And I was consuming it every day because I thought it was healthy. He said, it's weird, though. I've always been a really hairy, you know, Mediterranean kind of guy, and I've had to shave not only in the morning, but I have a 5 o'clock shadow. I have to shave before I go out to dinner. He said, after I was drinking the soy for a couple of months, I stopped having to shave every night, and then it got to the point where I only had to shave 3 times a week. My beard just stopped growing in. He said, and then I started noticing I was developing breasts. So we've all seen these guys, right, the man boobs, where you see guys, and you're like, dude, what's that? They could very well be that person is consuming large quantities of estrogenics. So he said, once I heard your radio show and I stopped consuming the soy, the man boobs went away, and I was able to start shaving again on a daily basis, and my beard came back. And he said, and what's more, I felt like my virility, my maleness came back. So we all know, everybody knows vegetarian men, it's kind of a stereotype, right? They're kind of wimpy. Well, there's a reason for that, because they're sucking down the soy, and they're replacing all of the normal substances that you should be eating to get protein. They're replacing this with this estrogenic substance. Now, I've had women say, well, then isn't that good for us because we're women? Don't we want to be more womanly? Nothing could be further from the truth. 80% of breast cancers consume estrogen as a fuel. So if you're eating lots of soy, if you have even a couple of breast cancer cells in your breast and you're eating soy, those breast cancer cells are going to use it like gangbusters, like Miracle-Gro. So the more estrogen that we are consuming in our diets, it is causing women to develop all kinds of reproductive cancers. It's causing men to develop reproductive cancers, and it's causing men to become effeminized, which is exactly what the global leaders would want from a population of angry men, would be for them to be so passive and wimped out that they couldn't do anything and turn into a bunch of pansy women. And it would also, here's the other thing about it. If you do the research, you will find that when they give soy to hamsters, they did this in Europe, that after a couple of generations, the hamsters, their fertility drops and drops and drops, and after the fourth or fifth generation, they're sterile. So the men can no longer impregnate, the males can no longer impregnate the females, and the females, to the extent that they do have babies, their babies have shriveled, if they're male, have shriveled testicles and genitalia that doesn't really even function. So this is, when we're seeing this rash of infertility, right? We've got all these fertility clinics and blah, blah, blah. We're seeing a rash of infertility. We're seeing a rash of miscarriages. We're seeing people having more and more difficulty to conceive. And this is all because of the stuff that we're eating. So do I think it's intentional? I have to say, based on what we know about soy, no society in their right mind would be feeding this to their population unless they wanted to make them weak, effeminate, and infertile. And so if it's not a conspiracy, it may as well be, because you've got Duane Andreas. He's the biggest political donor in history. You can read about him on Wikipedia even, Duane Andreas. And he traveled all over the world. We even went behind the Iron Curtain back when we were enemies with them. And he pumped this soy oil as a food to everybody. Now it's the number one consumed oil in Mexico, in Thailand, in Canada, in Jamaica, in the U.S., in the Ukraine. Soy is everywhere now. And do you know that it was back in the 1930s, I did a bunch of research on the history of soy. Back in the 1930s, there were these guys in America who decided they were going to...
I was going to say, you're back in the 1930s, I did this study. It's like, Catherine, you're not that old.
No. No, these guys in the 30s were trying to, they came up with this business idea that they were going to take this soy, which wasn't even used for animal food because it makes animals infertile. And so farmers wouldn't even give it to their animals. It was an ingredient for making paint. That's what soy was used for. But it was an industrial plant. So they somehow came up with this way of refining the soy and taking the poison out of it and trying to sell it. They realized they couldn't sell it. They tried to give it away, and nobody would take it. So you go from that era where they thought they were going to get rich from taking this like byproduct of making paint and sell it as a food, and nobody would even take it for free, to the point where today it's touted as a health food, and it is in virtually everything you eat.
Yeah.
It's in salad dressing. It's in margarine. It's in ice cream. It's in mayonnaise. If you eat a sandwich at your local sandwich shop, it's going to have either oil on it that's soy. If you eat French fries, they're fried in soybean oil. Every fried food that you eat at every restaurant you go to is fried in soybean oil.
Either that or either soybean oil or canola oil, which was used as an industrial engine lubricant, which also is not good for you either.
That's right. And we know that canola oil has actually been associated with heart lesions. So these are two, and by the way, both of them are genetically modified. About 98% of the soy consumed in the United States is genetically modified soy.
Mm.
So you add in now the genetic modification, the glyphosates that they're sprayed with, all that other stuff, and you're winding up with something that's quite toxic.
Mm.
So now a lot of people will say, well, what about the Asians? Don't they eat soy sauce? Yes. If you ferment the soy, you destroy the estrogen, which is very interesting. So soy sauce, which is fermented soybeans, is actually, it's slightly estrogenic, but it's nowhere near soy milk or tofu. The edamame, you know, the little soybeans that you can eat in a Japanese restaurant, that's just pure unadulterated soybeans. Don't eat them. They're very delicious. I love them, but they're very bad for you.
When we look at the facts of these of soy and the contamination of the food supply through GMOs and everything, people assume the intention first and then they go look for the evidence. Well, I think that if you look at the results of what's been happening to the food supply, I think the intention becomes quite clear.
Let me tell you something else, and I'll give you one more piece of evidence. And now it's going to blow your mind. You're not going to be able to not think about this. You know, all of this rise in homosexuality and in transgender and bisexual and gender identity issues that people across the globe seem to be experiencing right now?
Oh, totally.
That's exactly what you would expect if you were to douse people in gender-bending chemicals like soy. Because if you're a man, the thing that makes you a man and desire a woman is the testosterone and hormone levels in your body. If you take a functional man and you remove the testosterone from his body and replace it with estrogen, he will become very gender confused. If you take a normal woman and you begin messing with the chemicals in her body, she becomes slightly less confused. It seems to have a bigger impact on men. But you can also generate some of these kinds of gender difficulties in women as well. So there's a guy in Japan. This is one of the grossest stories. He actually cut off his own genitalia and then cooked it up in a meal and invited people to come and partake of this meal for, I don't know, $10,000 a piece, some crazy amount of money. And he was arrested not for cutting off his genitalia because he was out of his mind. He was arrested for serving potentially unsanitary food for a cost, for pay, that hadn't been government approved. So what I found interesting about this guy, aside from the fact that that's just crazy, was when he was interviewed, he said, I didn't cut off my male parts because I wanted to be a woman. He said, I really don't feel like I have any gender. In fact, I feel like I have no sex at all. And I just wanted to be neutral. So that's just one guy in Japan, but we're hearing this over and over and over and over. All the young people are reporting this, that not all of them, but many of them are reporting the same thing of not really having a clear sexual orientation. Not really clearly knowing who they're attracted to or not attracted to. Well, all of that attracted to or not attracted to, that is all driven by sex hormones. It is the actual hormones in our body. That's why when you're you know, seven, you don't think about sex because you don't have any hormones in you to make you think about sex. When you're 15, the reason all you can think about is sex is you're being flooded with hormones that are making you think about sex. So when you mess with that, And no longer do those hormones flow in a normal way. When you think about sex, it's all in your head. You're just going to imagine, I don't know, well, let me decide which one I want to be. So it becomes less a matter of biological drive that makes people normal men and women, and it becomes more an issue of societal preference. What do you want to be? I don't know. You want to be both? You want to be either one? So this is why we are seeing this immense explosion of gender confusion and shifting gender roles in our society, and not just gender, but sexual roles shifting in our society. And all this stuff that they've put in our food.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, if you tell people this, they say, you're homophobic, don't they? Because I don't know about you, but I think there's an agenda to facilitate this somehow, some reason, right? Strong, masculine men don't take stuff lying down, right? They fight, they kill,
yeah,
and that kind of thing. Whereas if you're totally gender bent and what have you, your ability to get angry and raged and so on and so forth, resist the New World Order, so on and so forth, doesn't freaking exist anymore. You just lie down and take it.
Right. That's right. Or you just play another video game, you just pop another beer, just have another Hot Pocket or another thing, French fries. You know, it's really, if you provoke or put into a dangerous situation men with varying levels of testosterone, the men with the highest levels of testosterone will respond the most aggressively. Now, whether that's good or bad, I don't know. Maybe in a city kind of environment, it's different from in the country. Maybe we don't need men responding aggressively. I don't know. But I will say this. It is exactly a one-to-one correspondence. One of the clearest correspondences in all of scientific literature is the correspondence between testosterone and aggression. So if you remove that testosterone, you remove the aggression. If you increase the testosterone, you increase the aggression. And obviously, you don't want to be surrounded by a whole bunch of aggressive males, but on the other hand, you don't want to be surrounded by a bunch of men who, if they are pushed around, and if the government does become corrupt and start taking away their health care and their jobs and their money and their independence and their dignity, you don't want to be surrounded by a bunch of men who will say, oh, okay, oh, just don't hurt me. You want some men who grow some cojones and say, no, heck no, you can't do that. So you asked me if I think it's a conspiracy. I do. I take a look at what Dwayne Andreas did and how he was able to perpetuate the propagate the use of soy across the whole planet. And you look at his background and who his political cronies were and what people in the very highest levels of banking and political power he answers to, then all of a sudden it all just comes into focus.
What would you say is the end game here? I mean, intention. I mean, are we going to be, I don't know, a species of transgender people, you know, for lack of a better definition?
I think the end point of all of this is they're going to get us to not even want to have bodies anymore and get us to take chips into our bodies and have neural implants and neural connections to the global brain. That's what I think is going to happen. I think eventually that Oculus Rift that I was telling you about, which makes it feel as though you're living in a virtual reality, I think that's where they want us to go. To where you don't even care about this physical body any longer, but you'll just upload your soul into the Matrix for safekeeping.
Yeah, that's exactly what it made me think of, is the Matrix there. Just make sure that nobody has any perception of reality or whatsoever. And I think this is another part of the New Age religion. Have you heard about all of this kind of stuff popping up everywhere?
Oh, yeah, and you know, I think it's going to all tie in ultimately, this idea that we're all going to reach global consciousness, we're going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya and sail off into the stars together. You know, this is the mark of the beast. This is straight out of the Bible. This is where people will get to the point where they're going to bow down and worship something in order to have a perception of immortality. And we're seeing that. We're seeing people already promising that. Google is saying that they're going to be able to cheat death and make you immortal. How are they going to do that? Well, they're going to do that by taking you and uploading you into the computer mainframe. And then this body thing that you have that's such a pain and you have to wash it and exercise it and take care of it, you can just dump it. You can just let it die. You know, you think about people playing video games all day. I don't know about you. I've met some World of Warcraft addicts who will spend 18, 20 hours a day playing the game. And when they have to unplug and look at the real world isn't looking so good for them. They're fat. They stink. They're surrounded by pizza boxes. Their wives have left them. They've lost their jobs. They have no income. Everything in their real life is terrible. And so that gives them even more incentive to just plug back into the game, because in the game they're strong and they're healthy and they're winning and everybody likes them and they have gold and swords and armor. And so obviously faced with those two choices, do you want to be some fat loser with nothing going for you, or do you want to be some, you know, dashing, handsome, amazing dude in the game? And eventually it's going to get to the point where you're going to have the option, and this is what I think is taking the mark of the beast. You're going to have the option of saying, forget it, I give up my mortal life. Go ahead, let me die, but let me live forever in this virtual reality. And I think that's going to be hell. I think that is hell. So there's my crazy thought.
A permanent fantasy world for all the people who are stupid enough to think that reality doesn't actually have value.
That's right.
Nor their own lives.
Once you get in there, you better believe, because it's very clear biblically that it's a deception. Once you get in there, then the torture begins. Once they own you, once the dark side owns you, body, mind, and soul, it's not going to continue to give you the nice things. It's going to give you the garbage. You know the old joke about the politician?
Is that you change, what was it, they're like diapers? You change them regularly because for the same reason?
Oh, no. I never heard that one. No, this is a politician. He dies. And he gets to the pearly gates, and St. Peter says, you're going to have two choices. We're going to send you down to hell, and you're going to try that for a day. We'll send you up here to heaven, you'll try that for a day, and then you can pick which one you want. So he gets to heaven, and it's nice. You know, he's playing harps, and there's music, and it's all calm and peaceful. But he says, all right, let me try hell. He gets down to hell, and it's a huge party, and the devil says, hey, come on in, and there's beautiful women, and he's playing golf, and he's got a Maserati. And he's just having a great time. Everything there is fabulous. All right, so the day ends. He goes back and he says to St. Peter. St. Peter says, what's your choice? He says, you know, I always thought I wanted to go to heaven, but I think I'll take hell. It was a lot more fun. So he goes, okay, boom. All of a sudden, the guy finds himself. He's in hell. He's in molten lava up to his neck, steam and screams everywhere, the souls of the damned screaming all around him. He's in agony. And the devil comes by and he says, what happened? What happened yesterday? It was so nice here. The devil says, oh, yeah, well, yesterday we were campaigning.
Yeah, it sounds about right, doesn't it?
He said, yesterday we were campaigning. Today you voted for me.
Well, I think that's kind of the way of the world. And I wanted to go back to something you said actually in the beginning of the broadcast, is about how we now have this massive increase of knowledge. You know, anything you want, you can now have access to. And it reminded me of the economic standpoint, is that as soon as one particular resource is totally abundant, suddenly it loses all of its value. So despite the fact that we're now swimming in available knowledge, nobody even wants it, because there's just enough. There's enough of it, and they can get it for free, so it loses its value.
Yeah, no, I think there's a real point to that, and this is why they're going into getting more and more invasive kinds of information. This is why they want to read your email and read what you search for and track you around and put trackers on your phone, because, you know, regular knowledge just isn't good enough. We want the intimate knowledge that we wouldn't have otherwise. So now we're starting to get into kind of perverse forms of wanting to know really intimate details about people. And that's being driven by the corporate sector and the government sector, but eventually it's going to make its way into all of our lives, where we're going to expect to be able to have that kind of access to information about each other.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, social media and these networking platforms have found, I mean, I will, let's say, for example, take myself, I've got two people who I'd call my best friends that I hang out with, and maybe 100 acquaintances or so in the real world. And, you know, there's my wife and so on and so forth. And then on Facebook, there are hundreds of people that I interact with and thousands of acquaintances, right? And what occurs to me is that I spend far more time with these distant digital acquaintances than I do with my real world peeps. So again, it's like the availability. You've got so much social interaction available online that you no longer want real social interaction. And in so doing, you can't hug people. You can't read body language. You can't do any of this thing. I mean, everybody gets into fights all the time on the internet because somebody says something, and because you can't hear the tone of their voice, see their body language or something, you completely misinterpret it and go nuts at them when they were actually trying to give you a compliment.
Yes, exactly. That is a good point. So I don't know. I'm of the belief that we need to pull ourselves out of this virtual world, which is so compelling and so addictive, and really take back those 16 hours a day or 11 hours a day, the 70% of our time that we're spending staring into screens, and actually start interacting with real people and doing real things again. So that when they come along and say, hey, just dump your real life, you'll say, no, my real life's great. Why would I want to get rid of this? Instead of spending all our time in the virtual world to where your real life falls apart, you don't have any friends, those couple of friends you have you no longer see anymore, and all your friends are in this virtual world. And then when somebody comes along and says, hey, dump your body, dump your real life, and live in the virtual world, you say, well, I practically already am, so okay. That sounds good. So I just think we need to regain our appreciation of the actual real world that we live in and start living in it again. And get out of all of this fakeness that's just wasting our time and destroying our relationships and us.
Yeah, somebody asked me the other week, Catherine, oh, what the hell did people do without cell phones? And I say, well, they would turn up at their mate's house, and their mate, instead of going, oh my God, why didn't you text me before you come over, and get really pissed off at their friend, they'd be like, oh my God, it's my friend, and invite you in and have a coffee or something.
That's a good point. It's so true. Yeah. Well, and we're the last generation to remember how it was before all this stuff. You know, the smartphone's only been around 7-8 years. Prior to that, people didn't carry around these phones all the time. So the fact that people can't remember what it was like before that, give me a break.
Yeah, people used to be smart and the phones used to be... people used to be smart, the phones used to be dumb, and now it's the reverse.
That's perfectly stated. Couldn't agree with you more. So, well, this has been really fun. Thank you for letting me talk about cancer and technology and soy and all my favorite topics. I always have a blast talking to you.
Let you. You couldn't be stopped.
I know. Had to get it out of my system.
Oh yeah. I mean, I find the Cancer Society does is they find people who are survivors of cancer, or they find people who've got relatives who have died of cancer, because they're the ones who are most passionate about it. However, the Cancer Society, to my mind, is like, isn't that kind of a bit manipulative? How many cures have you produced for cancer, Cancer Society? None. Do you produce cancer-causing sunscreen, though, and tell people to slather it all over themselves in order to prevent themselves from getting cancer so that the nanoparticulized aluminium goes through their pores and gives them cancer? Well, yes, we do. And do you make money off of that? Well, yes, we do. And you pay all your employees? Yep. So,
yeah, that's a really good point.
You've been around for 40 years as the Cancer Society, never come up with a single cure. Okay, now, if I was a builder... and you ask me, what do you do for a living? I say, I'm a builder. Really? How many things have you built? In 40 years, I've built absolutely nothing, ever, in any way, shape, or form. Would you think I was actually a builder? No. You'd think I was full of crap, wouldn't you? and then I'm just deceiving you for my own personal benefit in some way, shape, or form. So I could come up with some kind of a fake contract to say, hey, I'm going to build this house for you, give me the money up front, and then skip town. Maybe I'm just being cynical.
Well, the thing about some of the cancer charities, they're trying to provide support for people who've been diagnosed. The funding that they raise and contribute for medical research, I know the Susan G. Komen Foundation, which I have a lot of reasons not to really like, but they've done some good things. They've contributed a lot of money to cancer research that probably has helped to fund some of the breakthroughs that have happened. So I won't say it's entirely useless what they do. They've certainly helped raise awareness. You know, in the 1970s, this is in The Emperor of All Maladies, in that book, which is a really good overview of cancer and the fight against it over all these years. But in that book, they tell the story of a woman, a socialite, who wanted to have a support group for breast cancer patients or breast cancer survivors. And she posted the ad with the classified department at the New York Times, and they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't run the ad because we can't say the word breast in print, and we can't say the word cancer in print. So in the 1970s, you couldn't say either one. If you were diagnosed with breast cancer, you couldn't tell people what you had. It just wasn't talked about in polite society, apparently. And they wanted to say that there would be a meeting. They suggested alternative language, that there could be a meeting for women with diseases of the chest area. So instead of saying breast cancer. So I think in part it is the American Cancer Society, the Susan G. Komen Foundation, all the other cancer societies that really have, I think, at least raised awareness so we can talk about the issue, so we have more understanding of what to look for and how to diagnose it and how to self, perform self-exams. And
of course, they're not out there. They're not out there telling people, hey, by the way, eating all those soy and processed foods and all of that stuff causes cancer and everything, because that would just threaten the major evil Monsanto agribusiness.
I agree completely. That's a really tough message to get out there, because all the media through which you would spread such a message are funded by those very same people. So if Coca-Cola is your number one advertiser, you can't go doing lots of exposés on how corn syrup is bad for you. You can't do it. So you gotta get your news from sources that aren't funded by the major players, because that's the place where people have the guts to tell you the truth and not worry about losing an advertising contract or making some golf partner angry or losing their spot on the council and foreign relations seat. You got to find people who don't have those things at stake and who aren't vested in those interests. So
or breasted in them.
Yeah, thank you. So I actually need to run. I've so enjoyed talking to you. I went about double what I had planned to say.
Yeah, roughly, yeah.
It's a farm. Yeah.
You just got carried away.
I knew it. Where can people hear this broadcast so I can let my radio listeners know to tune in?
Well, let's wrap up the show then. It's thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, ladies and gentlemen. It's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, there are a bank account there and a couple of PayPal buttons. This is 100% listener-supported broadcasting. I'm one of the few that hasn't got advertisers and is totally supported of, by, and for the people. And this is part of the reason why there is such a massive diversity of guests, all the way from people you never heard about to people you hear from all the time and just want to listen to more. People like Catherine, for instance. So, yeah, other than that, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Thank you, Catherine, for participating. And quickly, rattle off a few of your websites and then we'll wrap up.
Yeah, so I do a daily radio show every afternoon, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. You can find that at kmashow.com or just my name, KatherineAlbrecht.com. I also help to create the world's most private search engine that you should be using instead of Google if you don't want to be having all of your personal information go into the Matrix and to the NSA, et cetera. You can go to startpage.com and use it instead of Google. We submit your searches to Google for you. They never see you, they only see us, and then we get the results and give them to you privately. We strip out all the tracking cookies, and then we forget we ever saw you. We delete all records of your visit, including your IP address. We have new email coming out at startmail.com. We've been working for about 3 years to build from the ground up totally private encrypted email that's so easy to use that even a beginner can do it. It is the only fully private PGP encrypted email that anyone can use. Total piece of cake, startmail.com. There's a 2-minute video. You can familiarize yourself with what it is. And if you mention at the bottom, there's a little form there, it's going to be available by invitation only. We're rolling out 50,000 accounts to beta testers who pre-signed up. And then after that, it's going to go into invitation only status. So if you would like to get an invitation, go to startmail.com. At the bottom, you'll see a form. Go ahead and fill it out to receive your invitation. Mention the Vinny Eastwood Show and my name, Catherine Albrecht. And when we go into the invitation phase of rolling out accounts, which will be this summer, then you will get an invitation for a StartMail account. You can pass that invitation along to somebody else. You can delete it if you don't want to take the account. You can sign up as many friends as you would like during this invitation phase, and they'll also get an invitation. But when those invitations are gone, then we'll be moving to yet another phase. StartMail will be paid, just to clarify. Somebody's got to pay the bills. If it's not the advertisers and the spies, then it's got to be you. It's $5 a month, which we think is actually quite affordable for totally private email that even we can't read. So that's startmail.com, startpage.com, the search engine, and, of course, my website, kmashow.com.
All right. And, ladies and gentlemen, when that comes out released, there's going to be a nice little jingle to advertise it called Walk Like an Encryption. All right. We will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for your attention and your donations. And just stay classy, San Diego. We'll see you again sometime.